lecture one, lesson one, talk one, had to do primarily with the premise as to why an awful lot of good marriages fail. And the basic assumption is that an awful lot of good marriages fail because they've got too much to reflect on that's good, and mediocre marriages don't reflect on much, don't expect much, and good marriages are failing more today than any time anybody's ever recorded. Session two dealt with the inner child of the past. I consider that, as I said last week, certainly one of the most critical, important insights and observations I have ever gained in my own marriage. We are all part of what we were. This pathological, pathos logos, the word pathos meaning suffering, the word logos means effort to express. The suffering of my childhood, the deprivations that were real or imaginary, fully 90% of all the marriage counseling I have done in my life, and fully 90% of all the problems I've had in my own marriage, were these little people still within me. That's so very critical. And I touched on it as the essential story last week, but shall now allude to it for the remaining of the time that's left in the sessions, the remaining four, counting tonight, because it's awfully critical. To put it philosophically, it's what the great philosopher, whose name now escapes me, what's his name? Martin Buber, thank you, I appreciate your help. Nancy, I usually count on you for that on Sunday morning. It's what Martin Buber calls the isness of the was, the wasness of the is. It's just totally unacceptable, to say nothing of a travesty of logic, to assume that everything I ever was is now gone. The fact of the matter is, most of what causes us trouble in our adult lives is the isness of the was, the wasness of the is, the little child that still speaks, that's not under control, that's not being raised. Tonight we come to the basic look at how to scratch the 20-year itch for those who've got it and for those who've got it coming. And what I'm really saying here is that any marriage that has any meaningfulness to it at all is going to last, and the longer it lasts, the more problems there are. And the more problems there are, the more there is to work with, and there is, in fact, an increase in the divorce statistics today, again, among people who have been married 20 years. I cannot begin to tell you how many times I hear and you hear somebody say, they were married 21 years and they're getting a divorce. Can you believe that? It's on the increase. So a look at how to scratch the 20-year itch, how to deal with that, from two perspectives, really, if I can carry this off, or in any capacity, it could be helpful, as a preventative type thing for those who've got it coming, and as a care type thing for those who are dealing with it now or have been dealing with it, because it's going to happen. Because there is no marriage that does not require you to mature and to grow up in order to maintain it. And the bottom line of all the conflict in marriage is the unwillingness to grow up, or perhaps the inability to know how to grow up. Because most people I talk to are really willing to pay almost any price they could possibly pay to make this marriage work. Most people want and are willing to do whatever is necessary to get the thing together, to get it on the track, to get the act together, but don't really know how. Which is why I'm talking about a lot of clinical things, such as pathological problems in early childhood, and such as these very predictable things as the 20-year itch and that sort of thing, because it is on the increase. And as we get into it, I want to really urge you to concentrate not on the symptom, but on the cause. We have a tremendous, an inordinate capacity to be preoccupied with symptoms. You don't have a problem because you drink too much. You drink too much because you have a problem. Drinking is a symptom. It's not the problem. It's not the cause. You don't have a problem because you're promiscuous. You're promiscuous because you have a problem. You don't have a problem because you've got a dirty mouth or a big mouth or a gossiping mouth. You have that because you've got a problem. And there's a world of difference between the symptom and the cause. And the cause is so tremendously critical, and that's what I hope to touch on. I read this letter the other day, I think it was in the Reader's Digest or somewhere, to an airline service. Sir, may I suggest that you get your pilots not to turn on the little light that says fasten the seat belt, because I've noticed every time they do, the ride gets rough. Now, that's just about as close to what I see regularly in preoccupation with symptom as opposed to cause. The cause is not turning on the light. Turning on the light is a symptom of bumpy weather ahead and the need to deal with it. And so I want to talk about symptom, but as tonight's session in actuality is really a transition, because I want to begin moving into some of the sexual problems in marriage, which are very common and very important. And of course, when you deal with a 20-year itch and with this sort of thing, the most common symptom is infidelity of some kind of sexual connotation. And so I'll begin working in that area, but let me share this with you. David Rubin. I like a lot of what he says. I'll tell you the genius of David Rubin. He says things generally and simplistically. And that's what most of us are looking for. Something that makes sense, that we can relate to, that's not so technical and so thorough that no other PhD will say, I find fault in that. But it's generalized. And he says this about the general problem. A marriage that has endured for 20 years is like a house built by a master craftsman. And I might add to that, every year leading up to it is that much more of that house as it is being built by a master craftsman. That house does not have to be demolished. It can be lovingly restored and revitalized. All that's really required is the will to do it plus hard work. Now, I react strongly to that word all, because you see, that's where the rub is. That's why, as I said on the first week, we often trade banyan trees, or we often trade partners, or we often change jobs, or we often change cars, or we often do whatever designates our frustration threshold, and we change it in on a new model, because it is working hard that we did not anticipate having to do. And we always like to raise the question in our conflicts of who threw the first stone. And as someone said, the great difference in marriages is not who threw the first stone, but who is willing to take the first stone, and begin rebuilding the wall, the house, the relationship. So, as a preventative type measure, and any other way you want to look at it, what is the cause? First of all, I want to begin with the most common and the one that makes people most angry, because so much traffic has been driven across it that it's now fallen into disrepute and we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater, and that is the menopause. I don't know how many of you have heard about the menopause. I don't know how much you're up on this sort of thing at all. You've read passages or books similar thereto, but the menopause, there is a point, it's a synchronicity. It's not so much, according to the best research, terribly biological and physiological, so much as that when most people are married 20 years, there tends to be a coinciding with changes in the blood chemistry in the body. And I'm not going to get into hormone replacement therapy, because an awful lot of things have been done, really marvelous things in the field of modern medicine to deal with the symptoms of menopause. But I want to just say that here is a very genuine problem, and I can't begin. I suppose this will come a little bit clearer to me as time goes on, but it's hard for me to understand that something as common as this is, people get into it, it causes tremendous disruption in their homes and in their private lives. It begins very early for some people, particularly with men. I'm in that group of people who believe that male menopause is far more lethal and far more destructive on a marriage and on the psyche than is female menopause. Male menopause usually does not have hot flashes. or cold feet or headaches or whatever else goes with menopause, but it's usually a deep insecurity. And one of the most common, here's what I want to say about menopause and really trying to deal with this thing as I've announced it. One of the most common problems in menopause is that when it begins to happen, premenopause mentality, especially in men, we tend to go home. Now, I'm alluding back to the inner child. I'm going to stay with that for four more sessions to one degree or another. But there is no time, there seems to be no time in our lives when we revert back more to the way our father treated our mother, or our mother treated our father, or we were treated as a child, then when we begin to hit that period of 30 to 35 to 40 to 45, menopause, premenopause, whatever the definition may be. And men have it worse than women. Now, I'm going to say something here that's going to irritate several people. I know because I've said it before, and I know it's true, but I am also one of these people who very honestly, I've said this on Sunday morning, I said it one Sunday morning here in church, but I really believe that men are fundamentally the weaker sex. And what I mean by that is that men are nowhere near as objective as women tend to be under crisis, particularly personal crisis. Now, you'll find a lot of men who can carry a lot more around the yard and who can beat up more people. And if that's what you call strength, then you've got it. But when you talk about the ability to live with those subtle nuances and innuendos of the psyche as it passes through just normal, everyday, run-of-the-mill stuff, men have more problems in premenopause than women have in menopause. And the main reason, as I perceive it, is we tend, I know I'm being repetitive, but we tend to go home. Again, there is no period in our lives that I have seen or anybody I have ever read that I trust has seen that makes us tend to reproduce our home environment. Here's a statement that you'll hear more between the ages of 30 and 50 than you will between the ages of 18 and 30, and that is, you act just like your mother. You act just like your father. I never liked your father anyway. And the truth of the matter is, he and she probably does, because it is at that point where the processes begin, where our greatest insecurities begin to come out, and we tend to begin copying that which we know best. We tend to reproduce. And we tend to change each other. You know, to me, there are several things I want to say, particularly in the remaining sessions, that are just simple, utterly simplistic, very generalized rules that are helpful as all get out. All the tremendous repercussions and innuendos notwithstanding. And one of those is this. If there could come into our lives and into our marriages the ability to make adjustments and not try to hold each other, I'm going to say more about this later on this evening, about 11 or 12, 11:30. But just for now to say that when we get into these periods of insecurity and there are changes physiologically, emotionally, psychologically, every other way, we try to hold each other. We try to bring them back. We try to maintain the status quo. Again, one of the most difficult and major causal factors in marital discord in good marriages today is that it was good, it was great, we're changing, we're getting older, everything is different. Life is full of detours. You don't go anywhere in a straight line. And yet we try to make everybody, the person we're with, just like they always were. I shared a lot of this last week, and now that I know I'm going to take some tapes home, I'm going to have to be more careful. But one of the things that's really helped what's-her-name and me in our marriage is that as we rock along in the years, and I'm very definitely, I know when I went into premenopause mentality, I had insecurities and feelings that I just had never had in my whole life. It was two or three years ago. I'm 45 now. And one of the things that's helping us most is not so much to maintain how each of us used to be, but to deal with what is and to adjust to it. Let me give you an illustration. Now, like most women, my wife handles problems that are personally threatening better than I do. That may be female, I don't know. But I handle problems. When things go to pieces, I handle them very well. When they're going along real well, I go to pieces. And she handles that real well. Now, if it's involving our children, our two boys, I can't handle it. I agree with the guy who said, insanity is hereditary. You get it from your children. You know? And when it comes down to children, she has to do it because I don't handle it well. But all of our married life, in fact, before we got married, if anything happened, you know, if there was somebody, we were walking along a park, somebody, she thought she saw somebody behind a bush, or after we were married, a burglar in the house, Sandra's first reaction was to run over to me, throw both arms around me, pin my arms to my side, and say, do something, don't just stand there, do something. Now, after 24 years, that ain't going to change. So we now have an agreement. And that is, next time there's a big problem, if you can't help me, at least don't add to the problem. And that's a big help. Now, just simply say that when you talk about menopause and you talk about why it's such a problem, it's not just because it's happened. It's that in good marriages, and remember, that's what I'm talking about. In good marriages, we've had all these 8 or 10 or 15, 20 great years. And remember what a great year is now. A great year is very much like the guy who'd been married 50 years and said that he had never once considered divorce. And they interviewed him on it and criticized him about it. And he said, no, I've never considered divorce in 50 years. I've considered murder on several occasions, but I've never considered divorce. Now, you've had 10, 15, 20 years of good marriage, and all that time was geared toward keeping it the way it is. And I've become convinced that one of the reasons menopause is so lethal in a relationship is not just because of the hot flashes and all that other stuff, but because our deep desire to maintain the status quo. That's threat one. Threat two, postponement. Try to find a better word. Others say it differently, but postponement. If you study fundamentally the average run-of-the-mill couple, you will find that there's always a hope for betterment up the road. Everything is going to get better. And then you see at midlife or the menopause or however you say it, things haven't already gotten better because we haven't been working at making them better. We're not communicating. We're not talking to one another. And all of a sudden, threat two is just plain old postponement. How many families, for instance, just on the pleasure principle, save so long for a rainy day that they don't do anything wherein it's raining today? They're always planning ahead. Now, I know that's not traumatic, and I know it's not dramatic, but it does become traumatic. I'm simply saying that the statistics in good marriages going bad, one of the basic causes that we're always putting off pleasure, reward, each other. Why, good couples that are happily married tend to take each other for granted more than couples that are worried about their marriage. I thought that was a pretty good statement myself. It certainly is logical. Couples who love each other and have a good thing going and have great security and great confidence in one another tend to take each other for granted and make the other one wait and make the marriage wait until they take care of other things because they can afford to do it. And couples who do not have a good marriage have to work too hard at it. And I'm saying that good marriages often go bad in the 20th year or thereabouts in midlife because postponement. We just postpone so very long. And of course, the answer is to just wake up to the fact that here's a human being with me who needs my attention, who needs my interest, who needs to be doing something with me and me with them and us together, and not always just putting things off. We become so habitually oriented at postponement that it's as hard to break as smoking or any other habit. So habitually oriented. But once a couple sees how much fun it is just to be together now and to do something that's fun now and not... You see, we all do this. Some of us blame ourselves more rigidly than others. But we all set out, intelligent people, and we love each other, and we plan, and we know how it's going to be when Ortho goes to first grade and when Effie Mae gets to be crowned Miss Cucumber, and right on up the row until we finally get them in college. And most good couples spend their whole first 10 or 15 or 20 years postponing. And it's so difficult to break. It's true, be it ever so undramatic. Threat three, the crisis of confidence. Now, that's not so much in myself as it is in my partner. You see, so very often, menopause and midlife and 2 decades of marriage and all of that, we talk about premenopause, especially in men, how they get down on themselves. They don't so much get down on themselves as they tend to go home, like the wife does, and reproduce their earliest home environment. The real rub comes in the loss of confidence I have in my partner. One time Bill put it this way, I feel guilty about it, but I'm beginning to wonder if Martha and I have anything to look forward to. I mean, we know all about each other and there are no surprises anymore. Maybe I need the excitement of a younger woman. Eleanor puts it this way, it's not that I mean to be disloyal to Tom, but I'm still vitally interested in everything that goes on around me, and he seems to be so stodgy. All he cares about now is business. I'm still looking forward to getting something out of life. Now, there's threat two, back again in threat three. Postponement, 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 until we come to the time where we have waited so long to be the couple we always wanted to be with that happy time and that friendship and that time of sharing and mutual interest that so many times in good marriages who want to hold it together, it's too little, too late. And I don't care who you see or how hard you work at it, it's often too little, too late. And it's not because you've lost confidence in yourself. In fact, it's quite the antithesis of that. I've gained more confidence in myself. It's her that I'm worried about, or it's him that I'm worried about. And this almost always signals postponement. It almost always signals lack of confidence in the other person. And when one partner begins to lose confidence in the other person, the most common expression of that is sexual infidelity. That's the most common expression. But this confidence crisis, threat three, can be dealt with. A few suggestions. Number one, and I've alluded to this, and it's one that I'm working hard on in my own marriage. Don't judge your spouse by the yardstick you used at the beginning of your relationship. I like George Bernard Shaw's statement on that. Bernard Shaw said, "The only person I meet who makes any sense is my tailor." He says, every time I see my tailor, he takes my measurements anew. Everybody else uses the one they've always had. And that is more true of marriage and more lethal in marriage, especially if it's been good. Because we would much rather let it stay good than have to grow up and mature and raise all these little pathological children that are within us, this suffering that's crying out in all of its strange ways. But just to make the adjustment, that's the important thing. I heard something the other day that really touched me very deeply. A friend of mine, whom I knew in college, had married a very beautiful young lady. And they're my age, obviously. We were in college together. And just right out of the blue, we were talking, and he said, "You know, my wife was always a very beautiful girl. And now," he said, "about a year or two ago, or 3 or 4 years ago sometime," he said, "it began to really bother me that she wasn't as beautiful as she was. Her skin, her skin tone, the wrinkles, the bulges where bulges aren't supposed to be, debulging where other bulges ought to be." He went down the whole list and he said, "But you know, something struck me." He said, "I was sitting and looking at her one evening, and she didn't know it. I thought of that song. It was several years ago. There was a song about, what's the name of it? Anybody know that dealt with that? It was one of the pop, country pops. But at any rate," he said, "I sat there and I looked at her and I thought, you know, every one of those wrinkles is a love sign for me. Because she could have had anybody in town back when I married her. And now the most sacred responsibility in my life is to love her because she was willing to stay with me until she began to lose what everybody else was attracted to." And he said, "A whole different feeling came into our relationship. And it wasn't because she became Miss America all of a sudden. Maybe it was just because he began to appreciate things that really matter. And that is, number one, don't judge people by the yardsticks you once used. Adjustment is the key. Everybody changes. Someone said, a beautiful girl is a freak of nature. A beautiful woman is a work of art. Now, of course, that takes two people working at it. That takes her, and that takes him. Secondly, I'm still talking about threat number three, this crisis of confidence. Secondly, in this sexual thing, nearly all cases of impotence or orgasmic impairment are a result of emotional conflict. It is very seldom that a couple has sexual problems where premature ejaculation or the ability to maintain erection or her inability to arrive at orgasm is not emotionally oriented. Again, pathological. And is very treatable. Very, very treatable. Thirdly, complain constructively. You know, one of the big problems in marriage today, particularly good marriage, is we don't know how to fight fairly. There is a clinic in Los Angeles that does nothing but teach husbands and wives how to fight together fairly. So that there is no hidden agenda, there is not the dumping syndrome where I've got all this anguish out of my childhood, my dad didn't love me and you slighted me, so I'm going to dump it all over you. But how to fight fairly. And that's such an important rule. For instance, you never say anything like, "You got a double chin." You never say anything like, "You're bow-legged," or "Your nose is too big." That's what we do. Boy, you know, keep coming back until you finally get them where they can't answer back. And when it's said, it's done. And so hard to repair. And of course, what that means clinically is this. That couples who fight like that are desperately afraid of the maturation process and don't know how to communicate. Don't perhaps even want to communicate. The wife who says, "I just can't stand it when you get up every night after dinner and march off to read the paper," is going to cause it every time. That's not good argumentation. It's like the mother walking along with her little son. She said, Junior, don't walk through the mud puddle. So Junior's going to walk right through the mud puddle. But the wife who says, you know, we don't see each other much, and it would mean an awful lot to me if you could just visit with me while I clean the table or help me, is saying a whole different thing. But we tend to attack. And again, the paradox. Talked about that the first night. Tried to talk about, warn you about paradox. The paradox is, the more in love you are, and the more secure you are in your relationship, the less efficient we tend to be in discussion, debate, and argumentation. We just tend to be crude because we know we can get away with it. Deep, deep paradox. Now, the goal in marriage is not to think alike, but to think together. You know, to be able to sit down with a problem, sexual problems, discussion, instruction, all problems, and talk about them. Talking about causes now. I'm talking about menopause as a cause of the 20-year itch. I'm talking about postponement, which you got to handle now, not then. I'm talking about the confidence of crisis, which has got to be handled now. People who do not communicate now are hard-pressed to communicate when they get at that age where they treat each other the way mom and dad treated each other, and if they didn't do it right, you're not going to either. And not only that, if they did do it right, now this is paradoxical, many of us go to the exact opposite so as to be us, and they may have communicated well, but when we begin reproducing them at a certain age, we don't communicate well at all because they did. It's so important to talk together. So very critical. Number four, subliminal stimuli. I'm going to hit this just very briefly because I want to develop it in the next two sessions. By subliminal stimuli, I mean intrinsically and basically that we live in a world where our cerebral cortex, our little blue gourd, is constantly bombarded by stimuli, and it's subliminal. We don't know it's happening. Ask anybody, for instance, who works a lot in marriage counseling, and he will tell you that beginning with the sexual revolution and sexual freedom, quote unquote, marriages and sex in marriage have increased. Which may mean, and in fact, in my opinion, does mean, that most of the information we're getting is really pretty dumb. When I'm sharing with a couple in marriage counseling, premarital counseling before marriage, one of the things I work hardest on is how this process of subliminal stimuli, these unaware impacts in our mind, so deeply affect our sex life. That's really the subject next week. X-rated, we're going to move everything over to Florida Field. And that's the best way to get a crowd is X-rated. But subliminal stimuli. A lady put it this way to me one time. She said, I've watched as the world turns until all I can think about is having an affair. That's subliminal stimuli. Do any of you read? Most of the child psychologists are saying today that probably the most single lethal thing in our society is Saturday morning cartoons when we put the children before the one-eyed babysitter. And that they very quickly learn that you can kill anybody and they'll not only come back together, but it'll all be fun in the chase. Very lethal stuff there. Very lethal stuff. And we sit in front of our own TV sets and we go to movies and we see things that, for one thing, when it is sexual, it's always the peak experience. And then every time, you know, so many couples a day I talk with, and you know, we're all the same. So many couples today, if they don't have a peak sexual experience all the time, you know, it's the bedroom Olympics, and there has got to be an Academy Award demonstration every time, and everybody would like to have at least 3 or 4 major, wonderful family orgies a week. This is the process of subliminal stimulation. But talking about adjustment, why, in every great marriage, there are times when it is so erotic that it makes all that other stuff look dumb. And then there are times when it's just a matter of just holding and loving. Just being close. I'm going to talk about that more next week. Sex isn't just for babies anymore. Any more than orange juice. Just for breakfast. But we don't want to adjust. As I said, and I know this from myself, people who've got a good marriage tend to leave their brains at work. They leave them at the office to pick them up when they get back because we don't want to have to think. We want to go in and flop down in our chair like Archie Bunker and get our can of beer and turn on the television set and tell what's her name to get the kids quiet. That's the way Dad did, and we're getting that age. And we tend to reproduce it more at that age. And we're bringing in all this stimuli. What I'm getting ready to say is not, oh, it is theological, but it doesn't have to be. In my sense, it is not. It isn't biblical. It isn't churchy. I would leave all that out easily and say that there is nothing that affects our lives more severely and with greater impact than that which we bring into our system. Frank Laubach, the world's leading authority in somatics, put it in systematic form when he said, whatever you read, perceive visually 20 to 40 times, you begin to believe it is so. Now, that wasn't said to make it true. It's a clinical observation. If you know your history at all, or I guess you can know history without knowing this, but Karl Marx, Lenin, instigated reading in the Soviet Union after the Bolshevik Revolution because the principle was that the communist form of government would not be accepted unless it could be visualized and brought into the brain and read over and over again. That's why there's still so much indoctrination. And I think we need to be so very careful. Not prudishly. But see, you pay a price either way. We either find those principles that lead to life or those principles that lead to death, and no matter how you mislabel it or what you call it, it still does what is its end result. Whatever a person sows, that he's going to reap. Ask any farmer. He'll tell you it's so. The movies, the magazines, and they have really changed. In fact, I was going to leave this out, but I'll say it quickly. Some of them have gotten so bad they're not really much danger anymore. I believe Playboy magazine, for instance, causes more disruption in homes than Penthouse. I'm talking about the process of subliminal stimuli. Now, I'm not selling Playboy magazine. I'll look at one if nobody's looking, you know. I call it research, but, you know, you need to keep up with what's going on in the world. But I'll tell you this, from just a clinical perspective, the more subtle a book is at the point of utilitarianism, that is where you use another human being for your own needs and let me say this the way I feel it. To hell with how they feel and what they need and what they want. The more a book pictures them as attractive and available and interested, the more lethal it is. When you get into some of this really junky stuff, it is so bad it's not really dangerous emotionally, except for those who are cripples. And that's another story. We're talking about good marriages now, you see, so I won't even go into that area. But the process of subliminal stimulation. Okay, I want to kind of, this is the transition. tonight, and so I want to begin the transition. And I want to talk a little bit more about the sexual problem, because I want to go into that very heavily for the next two sessions. And I don't mean from a physiological standpoint. Everybody and his little brother understands sex today. I talk to college kids who are getting married, and they say, you don't need to talk to us about this. We know all about sex. We're living together. Well, that's not the point. It is not the physiological that's the problem. It's the psychodynamic. It's the clinical. It's the psychological. So let me just kind of turn corners here and talk a little bit about the symptom of infidelity. And I want you to think of infidelity in the broad sense of the term, not just making out with somebody. It won't. Plus the fact that I think it makes it clearer. In most cases, it's simply the opportunity for the husband or for the wife to find that sexual gratification comes through affirmation. You love me. You see, I don't love you because I need you. I need you because I love you. And that's the fundamental difference in marriages. Eric Fromm said that. The marriage that says, I need you, or I love you, therefore I need you. I'm saying it wrong. How is it? The marriage that says, I need you, therefore I love you, is a pragmatic, utilitarian, brainwashed, subliminally stimuli mess. But the marriage that says, I need you because I love you. The bedroom Olympics can come and go. There will be great times of orgasm. There'll be times when it's a big loser. But it doesn't matter to the couple who needs you because they love you. And all the emphasis today on technique, and all that's not bad. Some people are just way too stodgy in that area, in their own marriage. But all this thing, you see, I would say this. It isn't usually too difficult if a woman remembers that satisfying a man sexually is 10% ability and 90% accessibility. Now, by accessibility, I don't mean, okay, get it over with. But I'm glad you need me because you love me. Every man or woman I have talked to in these 19 years have said, most people want to be faithful. But they have said, I wanted somebody to want me. And then I had an affair and it was nothing. Oh, it was a big blast for a while, but it was nothing. Why? Because sexual satisfaction begins and ends in the brain and has very little to do with anything else. And men and women alike would rather feel loved and affirmed and secure in a dumb, comical sexual evening, as those do come for everybody, than to just always be having a great affair. There are early warning signs. It's usually talk about, why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? Why aren't things like they used to? But it's the tiny, I'm coming down to the end now, it's the tiny grievances and irritations that gradually goad into infidelity or just the breakup of the marriage. And I say again, the better the marriage is, the more careless we are about those tiny little things, because our marriage can handle that. And most of the times when you lose him or her, they may in fact have some problems. Very often they've got early pathological problems of usually a female situation where they were never loved, and there is some sort of pathogenic or pathological drive toward an affair. But here are the critical questions, and I close with this. There are three of them. Write them down. Number one, what do I really want from my marriage? You don't want a substitute for all the work you need to do. You don't want a full-time rocket ship to the moon. Expectation is so critical. I love the story I heard the other day of this guy that bought a brand new van, went out on the interstate, and next time his friend saw him, he was on a crutch and walking along all beat up, and he looked like a mummy walking down the street. And he said, "What happened? Why aren't you driving your van?" He said, "I got out on the interstate with my new van. I set it on cruise control. I went in the back to get a cup of coffee, and the darn thing ran off the road." We preconceptualize marriages. We just walk away from the steering wheel, go back and fix ourselves something. And what do you expect in a marriage? Well, you expect to have to grow up with another person. The two become one. Secondly, what am I doing to endanger our marriage? That's one of the most mature questions that can be asked. Bear with me, I'm right at the end. What can I do? One of the fundamental laws of psychology is the healthiest person in any relationship has to carry the biggest load. A woman, could be a man, but a woman will come in and say to me, "My husband is an alcoholic. What can I do about it?" And I talk to her about it, and she says, "But that puts work on me. He's the one with the problem." But the healthiest person has to do the most work. It's always the person least wounded who has to drag the most wounded off the field of battle and care for them. And I don't know why we even think that should be different psychologically in our marriage. Another very important law is this: you cannot change the way someone acts toward you. There's no way you can do that. They've got their own mind. God can't do it. The free will is there. If they want to be a runny-nosed little boy or little girl all their lives, you can't change that. The only hope we've got is by changing the way we act toward them. Rule number one, what do you want from your marriage? Rule number two, what am I doing to endanger our marriage? And thirdly, sequentially, what can I do about it? Let me give it to you in one word. But I've tried to share this word with couples over the years, and I've spent maybe 10 sessions with one couple on this one word, so you know how inadequate this is going to be. But the word is vulnerability. We don't want to be vulnerable. Why, I see so many 40-year-old men whose marriages aren't what they ought to be, who want to be loving and touching and kind and reach out to their children and say sweet things to their wife, but they don't have the guts to be vulnerable, just to run the risk of being laughed at or snubbed. And I'm not putting them down, because that's the hardest thing in any marriage, is to be vulnerable. When there's been a bad sexual scene or things just haven't been working out right, the ability to be vulnerable, to go in and reach out, and you may lose the end of your fingers, but you got some left to reach out with again. And most marriages ultimately make it when there is vulnerability. The third question is, what can I do about it? I can be vulnerable. I can sacrifice or subjugate my ego and be more geared to their needs. Well, people need to talk together. They need to plan together. I think one of the most important things in a marriage is to cultivate mutual interests. See, all this helps us be together now, not later. Last year, Sandra and I went through one of the probably most rocky 2 or 3 months of our marriage. It was just really miserable for the most part. And we finally went out and bought a little camper. And I didn't want to camp, walk along the trails and a bunch of tourists and red bugs. And I just wasn't it. But we bought it because our marriage had to have something. And it's just been marvelous. Just been marvelous. To do something together. Now. Not postpone it, but now. A lot of people will get out of their marriage before this time comes, because people talk about it and they know it's rough, and we do hate to grow up. We would rather be married to someone who will do the growing up and will maintain, let us stay the way we want to be without any effort or any work. But you know, the really happy marriages are those that find that if you don't use the same measurements and you can make adjustments and can affirm this human being and love them and be loyal to them at the breakfast table, it gets better all the time. Someone put it in these words. A cynic once complained that marriage starts with a prince kissing an angel and ends with a bald man sitting across the table from a fat woman. But the secret that eludes all cynics is that there are so many bald-headed princes and there are plenty of slightly overweight angels. And like sex, happiness does not begin in orgasm, but it's a matter of the brain, the mind. This person cares about me, and I'm going to try to care about them. That's how you scratch the 20-year itch, for those who've got it and for those who've got it coming. Next week, we'll meet on Tuesday evening at 7, and I want to continue this, only I want to get much more exciting. I want to talk about two things fundamentally. The problems that begin to happen graphically, I want to do some graphs clinically, in dating, in adolescence. And this is good stuff for your kids, by the way. I've shared this with an awful lot of teenagers. It's been seems to be helpful to them, so they tell me. And then secondly, into the graph itself, into marriage. There are very predictable things that happen, very predictable responses. And then I want to talk about primarily the main subject, what sex is really for. It's not for babies. That's purely incidental, utterly secondarily, next Tuesday evening. Thank you and good night. In 3 minutes, we'll have a talk back.